Welcome to the Metro Connection Podcast, an award-winning news magazine with a fresh perspective on the communities surrounding the nation's capital.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
85 News.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David Furt. The calendar still says it's summer, but we know that's a dirty lie. For all intents and purposes, summer has been packed away until June 2008. Yes, it's that time of year when we reluctantly have to let go of the carefree days of July and August, but we don't have to let go of the memories. And that brings us to camping. Some of the most indelible summer experiences happen under canvas. Even if things didn't go so smoothly, even if we had to deal with bugs and damp firewood, even if relaxing turned out to be a lot of hard work, family camping trips always seem to have their own chapter in the book of nostalgia. And so it was with the Henderson family, when three girls and their mom set out to spend a night together in the great outdoors. Gemma Hooley tagged along on the camping trip this summer, which started with prep time in the Henderson suburban kitchen.
Is it all smooshed together?
No.
Yeah, I think that needs to be smooshed some more.
The best campfire suppers are made with no fuss and no cutlery. If you're really brave, you can also try making the entire meal in one plastic bag.
Yeah, you're going to mush it all together with the eggs.
Okay.
Yeah, you can take a look at the directions. You have the book over there.
Yeah. Here, do you want to crack an egg? You crack it over the sink. And then put it in the bag, okay?
Nanette Henderson and her three youngest girls, Emma, Paige, and Grace, are poring over campfire recipes in their kitchen in Northern Virginia. The main course? Meatball stuffed onions called Cozy Caves. And that's just the beginning.
Okay, so we have the moose lips, okay, and then we've got the caves. You have to put the ground beef, the egg, the salt, and the pepper into a sealable plastic bag. And I'll work on the onions.
Yes, somewhere in there with all the hamburger meat and onions and eggs, you heard moose lips. Happily, the recipe for moose lips does not call for any actual moose. You take slices of red apple, cover them in gooey peanut butter, and then stick on mini marshmallows for teeth. It's a messy business.
I'm going to wash my hands.
Good idea. I think we're just about done.
With the food packed, it's time to head out. For their overnight camping trip, the Hendersons chose a wooded campsite in a park not far from their house. There's a fire pit, a picnic table, and a round, leafy space with lots of room for their tent.
All right, you guys know how to do this. Let's do it so that the doors are on this side and that side, okay?
Wait, it goes like this, right?
Well, let's lay it out first to make sure we've got the doors in the right direction.
We do. You push it in like that, so that way it hooks onto the tent. Okay.
This is a large green and blue tent, one of those tall domes that you can stand up in quite easily, where you won't have to get dressed lying down. But all that standing headroom calls for long, bendy tent poles.
You're weird.
Mom, can we joust with these?
I don't think so.
Paige, would you like to joust?
The summer night settles in the woods as Nanette and the girls set up camp. It's cloudy, but there's no rain in the forecast, so they decide to leave off the fly sheet. If any stars do peep through the clouds, they'll be able to see them from their sleeping bags.
Wait, Mommy, go on the other side and pull the corner.
Pull that side towards you a little bit. There we go. That's good.
The ground is not soft right here. Can we pour some water on it?
You think that would do it?
Well, it would soften it a little. Ow, I hit my hand! Do you think that's far enough in?
Yeah, that's fine.
We're good tent pitchers.
That was pretty fast, actually.
Yeah, faster than when Dad's here.
With the tent finally up, there's one more really important task before building the campfire. And it calls for a small air pump.
It needs more. quick, Mother, because I have to screw this on.
How is it? Okay, so see, this is for me, and then you, one of you can go this way, and one of you can go this way, and someone can sleep there in the corner.
What? Hey! Hey, no...
No jumping on it.
So what we have here is a two-person inflatable mattress. There are four campers. Nanette has already secured one berth. The girls will have to compete for the other one.
I think we'll just have to see who's nicest to me.
There's air coming out right here.
Seriously?
No.
You know?
Mom said that who's nicest to her.
Yeah, whoever's nicest to me by the end of the night. How about that?
Oh, snap. I burned Mom's eyes.
Oh, thank you, Grace.
With the sleeping lottery over, the sisters head out to build their campfire the way they were taught in Girl Scouts.
It's Vaseline and cotton balls because it's supposed to, like, help the fire burn, and it helps get it going.
All right, do you guys see any really small, tiny sticks? Go pick a bunch of small.
Yeah, I was using them, and then I threw them all out.
Oh, should have saved them.
Remember those meatball-stuffed onions, the cozy caves? They're going on the hot coals now, wrapped in tin foil. Emma and Paige take turns in their dad's giant yellow barbecue gloves, turning the coals and nestling each onion into its own perfect hotspot. Away from the flames, it's time to lay a tablecloth for dinner and to look for little sticks to use as skewers for the corn. Then the girls find a distraction, packed away in the emergency kit.
What's a power generator?
That's how you actually can power it up if you keep cranking it. If the battery's out, that'll recharge the battery.
Wait, will it work right now?
I think the battery's already charged.
Will it still turn on?
I think there's got to be like an on and off. There you go. Besides that, I think it just gives you weather anyway.
Grace, I was trying to listen to that.
Oh, Grace.
Temperature 1 degree at Martinsburg. Skies.
You just evacuated the whole campground.
Now seems like a really good time to check on dinner.
Okay, well, we're taking one of the onions out. Do you want to come see?
Oh, that looks sort of gross. Okay, it's a good thing that those are just layers of the onion. I thought it turned the meat onion color.
And that campfire chemistry settles over the group as the girls reach for roasted onions, now soft and buttery in their foil parcels, and melt cheese squares over steaming potatoes.
Okay, you gotta be careful, because you get to a point when all the steam is gonna come out. There you go. And there was some grated cheese.
The best campfire meals have at least three dessert courses. Even full bellies are never too full for chocolate and marshmallows. The girls decide it's time to deliver a s'mores tutorial.
It's got chocolate, marshmallows, graham cracker. You roast the marshmallows. You put it in with the graham cracker and chocolate and you eat it.
If they're gooey, your finger will kind of like sink in a little, but it won't get messy. Those are probably done. Oh yeah, those definitely
yeah,
roasted.
Those are done.
Your marshmallows are probably good to go.
It turns out that Grace is something of a marshmallow magnet.
Did you call me Grace?
Drop marshmallow on the floor. Now it's on my shoe.
Oh.
Wasn't me.
It wasn't you? Someone dropped marshmallow on the floor and now it's on your shoe. It certainly is. Yeah, the tent is off limits for you for a little bit, I think.
With molten marshmallow oozing through her Crocs, Grace joins her sisters for a bedtime story at the picnic table, next to the fading fire.
Please be quiet, said the wisdom tooth. I'm trying to read. Pipe down, wise guy.
The book is called Sweet Tooth. It's Grace's favorite. As the girls read, Nanette opens the last of the campfire treats, a foil-roasted banana with melted dark chocolate.
Rotten teeth. The end.
On a summer's night in the leafy woods of northern Virginia, the stars eventually trump the sugar, and the Henderson family campers drift off to sleep. For Metro Connection, I'm Gemma Hooley.
Gemma Hooley's big camping trip was produced with Chris Nelson. We'll be right back. At 16 minutes past the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
Good afternoon, I'm Matt McCleskey. Beginning September 17th, the WAMU radio community enters a new era. At 88.5, our schedule will fully embrace news talk programming 7 days a week. And HD WAMU 3 offers alternative NPR and live news programming, including Talk of the Nation at 2 p.m. Our complete schedule is at WAMU.org. WAMU 88.5 and the BSO at Strathmore are giving away 15 pairs of tickets to the 2007-2008 BSO season preview concert with Maren Alsop. The performance is on Friday, September 14th at 8 p.m. at the Music Center at Strathmore. More information is available at WAMU.org under calendar. Currently 87 degrees in Northwest Washington at 118.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David First. Coming up, experimental music and DC comedy. But before that...
Nothing is so heartbreaking as the picture of starving children in Darfur and elsewhere.
Senior commentator Fred Fisk.
According to the United Nations, some 850 million people worldwide suffer from chronic malnutrition. Jonathan Schwartz of Mother Jones magazine did a study of worldwide malnutrition. I was quite shaken by it. We read of hunger due to natural disasters or wars, and it's sad. But that so many human beings starve because they can't afford to buy food is painful and should wrench the conscience of every thinking person. I was quite proud to read that the United States contributes more than half of the world's $4 billion in annual food aid. We're compassionate and we're the world's richest nation. We should give more. But my pride in our generosity was somewhat tempered when I read that our charity is mixed with the determination of some groups to profit from our giving. The U.S. Agency for International Development and other agencies must buy only American-grown food from American conglomerates. 75% of it must be shipped in American flag vessels, and due to rising transportation and business costs, the amount of food actually delivered by U.S. aid programs has declined by more than 50% over the past 5 years. My pride in our charity is further diminished when I read that the European Union just sends cash to groups on the scene who buy and distribute food without all the cuts taken by American interests. Congress is now considering a proposal which would allow 25% of food aid to be distributed as cash grants. The move, however, is being opposed by such struggling entities as the shipping companies and agribusiness giants like Archer Daniels Midland. Are you sick to the stomach yet? Well, this little nugget might do it for you. It turns out that when the food finally gets to where it's needed, it is often given to such non-governmental organizations as Feed the Children and the Red Cross, who then sell much of it to raise money for their organizations. In the past 3 years, these organizations have sold off $500 million in food aid. Some groups, including CARE, are pledging to stop that practice, and there's increasing pressure from the State Department and the Office of Management and Budget to convert some of the budget aid to cash aid. Hey, I don't oppose the profit motive. It served to make us the successful and powerful nation we are. There are, however, considerations which should come before profits. Hunger and starvation top the list. Congratulations to Jonathan Schwartz and Mother Jones for shedding light on this problem. I hope that it helps to move us from self-interested charity to genuine charity. This is Fred Fisk.
The D.C. Sonic Circuit's Experimental Music Festival kicks off tonight. In a town that boasts so many gospel, choral, orchestral, rock, and blues choices, the month-long festival offers a sustained chance to experience cutting-edge experimental sounds from local and international artists. We're joined by the director of the Sonic Circuits Festival, Jeff Surak. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
Now, this is the 7th annual Sonic Circuits here in D.C.?
Yes, that is correct. The first one was held in August 2001. And it was a curated program sponsored by the American Composers Forum, which is a national organization. The D.C. chapter put it on, and the D.C. chapter has been putting it on ever since. The national organization ceased promoting and organizing the festival in 2004, and we're one of the few cities that has actually consistently put it on.
After that safety net went away,
Still, after the funding dried up, we're pretty much left on our own devices.
So. But pulling it off.
Yes.
How do you guys define experimental music? Is it mostly electronic? Is it improvisational? What exactly are we talking about here?
It's a mixture of those things and many other things and pretty much anything else. You could ask any person who supposedly makes experimental music, and they'll give you a totally different answer.
Well, the very name experimental, you figure it could be anything under the sun.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a good way to think of it is more that the experiment is not done by the performer, but more by the listener or the person in the audience, because they're the one taking a chance, trying something new, and to see what the end result will be. So for them, it could be an experiment in listening in a different way, perceiving a performance in a different way, where instruments can be utilized in not the way that they're traditionally used. Different elements of music are explored rather than just the usual rhythm and melody, where that's about 99% of all popular music, whereas in experimental music, quote-unquote, that is just a small fraction of the audio dynamics that are explored. Texture plays a big, important part, I think, in experimental music. The layering of sounds, the contrasts of different audio sources, of different materials utilized to create a sonic environment for the listener.
Can we hear an example of someone who's going to be at the festival?
Yes, the band Hum Crush from Norway. They'll be performing this Saturday at the Warehouse on 7th Street, and the name of this track is called Hornswoggle.
And this is Hum Crush.
Hum Crush.
Quick example of music by Hum Crush. Now, this is a mixture of electronic sounds and what sounds like live percussion.
Yes, it's live percussion and live electronics, actually. So it's not canned electronics where somebody's just hitting a button on the laptop or on a MIDI-controlled synthesizer.
And that really has a robotic sound, though. This is being performed by live musicians?
By two people, actually. Mm. One person on keyboards, another person on the drums and electronics.
That's a frenzied, intensely rhythmic sound that they've come up with there. There's a lot of intense musicianship involved with this group.
Yes, it's very tight.
Not a lot of obviously recognizable melody here, but certainly a very recognizable rhythm pattern and complex rhythm at that.
Yes, it's definitely an exploration of rhythm.
Is there any intimidation factor to attending the festival for audiences that maybe don't typically go to see experimental music shows? Like, is it this like kind of like the hippest record store in town where you better know your stuff to go in there? Do you need to know anything about this music?
No, totally not. I mean, we even have parents bringing their kids to these shows. And all the shows at the Warehouse are all ages. So parents, feel free to bring your kids to experience something different.
You're not going to get the guy up there with a squalling electronic feedback sound with a megaphone cursing for 45 minutes.
I don't think there'll be any cursing, but I...
at least not at the all-ages
show. But you probably will get a lot of, you know, things of quite wide dynamic range. So if you're sensitive to loud sounds, please bring your earplugs.
Just to be on the safe side.
Yes.
That's a good idea. Well, let's hear another example of some of the music. What's next?
The next thing we have queued up is Nick Dakofsky and the Sirius String Quartet. They are based out of New York. And this particular piece is called Tube Mouth Bow String for the string quartet, talk boxes, and harmonizer pedals. So it's quite an active piece for the performers to do, since they're not only playing their instruments, but they're actually moving their feet and moving their mouths while the sound is from the instruments is fed through tubes back into their mouths. And then they're vocalizing, sort of forming vowel sounds with their mouths, which changes the tonal color of the instruments. So the overall effect is of a string quartet multiplied by several. It's very dense. There's a lot of harmonic intensity and color to this piece.
Sounds like a physical performance as well.
Yes, it is. Something very interesting to see.
And what's the name of this group?
This is Nick Dakofsky, and he's the composer, and he also plays with them, and the Sirius String Quartet.
Okay, let's hear a quick example. That is called Tube Mouth Bow String.
Yes, it's a very descriptive title because it's telling exactly what's involved in creating this music.
Experimenting with textures and also some little halftones in there.
Harmony, definitely. The harmonizer pedals are what are adding the sort of the overtones to the top and to the bottom end.
You mentioned this was a string quartet. Is there a stringed instrument being played in
there? It is actually your standard string quartet, two violins, viola, and cello.
And that's what you see when they're on
stage.
That's
what you see, plus the standard harmonizer pedals, which are quite often used by guitarists, and the talk boxes, which were popularized by Peter Frampton in the 70s by his live album.
So this is that classic wonk-wonk kind of sound
exactly.
That you hear on Frampton Comes Alive
exactly.
From the 70s?
the same device, but without the wanky wah-wah sound.
So. What a fascinating new use of that device here.
Yes, yes. That is probably one of the hallmarks of experimental music, is using already established technologies or instruments, but try to push the limits of their original intentions.
Now, this group that we just heard an example of is from New York City.
From New York, yes.
Are there any local artists on the schedule?
There are a whole slew of local artists. Just about every night of the festival, there will be some local performers.
And your project is also part of the schedule?
Yes. It's called All Violet. It's myself and another local artist, Scott Allison.
All Violet.
Yes.
We're speaking with Jeff Surak, the director of the Sonic Circuits Experimental Music Festival. And Jeff Bogato, who joins us for our Mondo DC segments on the show, and in fact will be on later in the hour, he runs an experimental music series in town called The Electric Possible, and his Sunday Electric Possible show is also part of the festival, the Sonic Circuits
Yes,
festival?
Yes, that is correct. That is September 9th, this Sunday, at the George Washington University Phillips Hall in the basement, and that starts at 8 o'clock.
There's an option to buy a festival pass, but can you also attend individual shows if you just want to get your feet wet?
Yes, you can go to any of the shows singly, and some of the events are free, actually. There's two events at the Warehouse, a film screening on September 12th, I believe, and also September 15th during the day, there's a matinee performance as well.
You know, it seems like not a day goes by where there's not a story in the media about the death of the music business, or at least of traditional big record labels.
And let's hope it dies sooner.
and, you know, there's many reasons for this. We could go into a long list of reasons, but one, the way music is being downloaded. Mm-hmm. Another being the content that they provide that many people are not satisfied with.
Totally.
something like sonic circuits, does it provide an outlet for people who are so frustrated that they're not finding or knowing about the music that might excite them?
Oh, yes, totally. And many of the artists performing in sonic circuits only release material on net labels, which is just labels you can go and download the music for free. So it's definitely an alternative to the standard corporate music machine and systems of distribution.
You mentioned one venue that was going to have some family-friendly shows. Where was that happening?
Yes, that would be at the Warehouse, which, you know, officially is closing at the end of the year, but it will be open for the festival. All the shows will be starting at 8 o'clock on time, since each night there will be about 8 to 10 performers, and we'll be using two performance spaces. So as soon as one artist finishes their piece or performance, the audience will be sort of encouraged to go move on to the next space. So the music is continuous.
How long does each set typically run of each performance?
Usually about 30 minutes.
Okay. So a great way to sample some music, and if you hate one of them, it's only 30 minutes. Stick around and see what comes next.
It's like your mom always told you to eat your Brussels sprouts because there was a reason for it. It's good for you, you know.
So there might be some Brussels sprouts on the schedule, is that?
Yes, and some yams and some rutabagas and broccoli and all that other good stuff.
All the good stuff.
Different colors, different textures. It's all good for you.
All right. Well, the festival, the Sonic Circuits Festival, starts tonight. What's happening tonight and where is it happening?
Yes, it starts off tonight at 8 o'clock sharp at the Velvet Lounge on U Street, which is pretty much across the street from the U Street Metro. We'll have a whole mix of stuff going on. We have Fry Band from the Netherlands, Joao Abri from Berlin, Brown Wing Overdrive, which is two people from D.C. who relocated to New York.
Brown Wing Overdrive?
Brown Wing Overdrive. It's sort of a very humorous electronics with banjo noise type of performance.
Electronics with banjo?
Yes, yes.
Oh, interesting mix there. But the evening as a whole, we have some free jazz, we have some electronics, we have some banjo.
We have some droney stuff. We have some sort of a sound installation in a way. Joao Abri's piece is called The Backyards of Berlin, which is utilizes recordings made of backyards in Berlin and sort of layered and processed and mixed together.
What happens on stage when someone is playing these recordings? Are they just kind of shuttling back and forth between stacks of equipment?
It could be that.
With a furrowed brow?
It could be the furrowed brow. It could be the scratching of the chin. It could be staring at the glow of the computer screen. Or it could be somebody who's like jumping up and down in your face and in the audience as well.
Anything goes.
Anything goes.
And bring the earplugs just in case.
Just in case. You never know.
Okay. Well, Jeff Surak, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you again, Dave, for having me.
Jeff Surak is the director of the Sonic Circuits Experimental Music Festival. It kicks off tonight, Friday night. And for more information, you can visit our webpage, metroconnection.org. And Jeff, can we finish with a little more music?
Yes. We have up next an artist from Vilnius, Lithuania, Antanas Jasinka. And this piece is called Nine Sanare.
Labai gaila. Ir lygis dabar varo šalies.
We go from cutting-edge music to DC comedy. Washington is a power center, a city that attracts driven, passionate, and committed people, so you would think it would also be a place that could use a good laugh at the end of the day. But this is a tough town for comedians. DC has spawned its share of headliners, but comics often wind up having to skip town in favor of LA or New York, where established comedy clubs are plentiful and provide exposure to film and TV scouts. Metro Connection's Stephanie Kay has been spending late nights at the open mics and comedy clubs around town to get a sense of the state of comedy in the district.
Just ended, bro.
Just ended?
Yeah. We don't get that much love around here.
That's John McBride, one of the organizers of The Bomb Shelter, a group that holds events for comedians at the club 18th and Red in Adams Morgan. They bill their Thursday evening performances as a shelter from comics who bomb.
We say we want to start a show that's free, and it'll be good, and it'll be clean. So when people come in here, they'll be like, wow, I didn't know this existed. And that's why we started this.
The Bomb Shelter doesn't let just anyone get up on stage. After perfecting jokes at open mic events, comics are allowed on their list. Being funny is serious business. McBride describes the life of the average D.C. comedian.
We do open mics, try to write new jokes. We go from bar to bar. People start rooms, and maybe they go for a couple years. A lot of times they just die, but we try to really just keep them going so people can try out new jokes, hopefully grab gigs and do what they do. We understand there's no TV people in D.C. That's fine. But we still want to practice. We still want to get as good as we can be. We're all eventually, if you're really trying to do this seriously, we're going to leave. It's just the way it is.
D.C. is typically viewed as a stepping stone that allows comics from other cities to try out the waters before moving on to New York or L.A. Comic Jay Hastings is from Greenville, South Carolina.
I'm just a guy who dropped out of college who had an inclination to tell jokes for a living.
It all started when he told a few jokes at an open mic event in South Carolina. The manager told him he was funny. One thing led to another, and
I lied and told him I'd been doing comedy for like 6 months, and I'd never done it before. And he's like, can you do 20 minutes? And I was like, yeah, no problem. How hard can 20 minutes be? He was like, yeah, you're kind of slow, but he was like, yeah, you should move to D.C. So I was like, all right. I just dropped out of school and was drinking and cooking in a kitchen, and I was like, something's got to be better than this. So I moved to D.C. and started doing comedy.
For now, Hastings is happy getting his comic education in D.C.
I look at L.A. and New York as finishing schools. So I'm trying to get my associate's degree in D.C., and I'd like to go graduate from a real college.
After 2 years in Washington, he has it pretty well mapped out as a great place to cut your teeth.
There's an A-room club. There's a couple B rooms around the area as well, and there's a pretty healthy open mic environment. So in order to like kind of get a sturdy foundation of your comic standing, great place. You can hit the ceiling pretty quick if you start doing comedy well.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the DC Improv. All right, Tuesday night, it's showtime. Let me hear you make some noise.
The one A room that Hastings is referring to is the DC Improv. The club doesn't headline locals very much, but they do let them open for bigger, nationally known performers.
I'm a comedy geek.
Allison Jaffe, the self-proclaimed geek, manages the Improv.
D.C.'s a great town for talent. So many major headliners came from here. Lewis Black, Wanda Sykes, Tommy Davidson, Dave Chappelle. You know, this business is tough. It's really hard to break into, but there's definitely some talented people.
For those who are just taking their first steps onto the stage, the Improv even offers courses.
We teach improv classes and also stand-up classes and also public speaking.
And maybe some of D.C.'s budding young comics will stick around.
You have to make connections with people in New York and L.A. Physically, do you have to be there? If you got your connections and you live in D.C. and you got a manager in New York, good for you. But, you know, D.C., the Improv's pretty much the best room in the area as far as work. And there's hundreds and hundreds of people looking for work, and we just don't have that much of it.
Opportunities at the club are limited. It's hard enough, even with big names, to draw a crowd.
We are a business. We are, you know, a thriving club, and we do what we can for the locals, 100%. But when it comes to actually being able to afford to stay open, we got to book people that can sell the tickets. I mean, we have major, major headliners here with amazing television credits and movies, and we struggle selling tickets. I think there's so much interest in comedy. There's maybe just not enough people that have free time. I mean, I don't think D.C. is going to be like the Mecca Hollywood of comedy. It's politics. It's, you know, that's what we're the Mecca of. You know, we have the most government workers all here in the White House. I mean, that's really D.C. And throw in, you know, a few comedy managers and agents. Yeah, I can't see it working here like that.
Trying to get an official analysis of the situation, I headed to where else? The Ivory Tower. And the office of Professor Chris Palmer.
I make films, and I write, and I'm writing a book, and I do a lot of so-called creative things. But amongst all of those things, the most creative thing I do is to try and write a short joke. It's very hard, very challenging.
Okay, he's not a professor of comedy, per se. But between teaching at American University and flying around the world to film IMAX-sized adventure documentaries, he finds time to stand in front of the Saturday night crowd at the Hyatt Regency Bethesda.
I've always given a lot of speeches with the jobs I've had and always used a lot of humor. It is a challenge, though, to design and create a joke. That is incredibly difficult, and it takes me about 2 weeks to produce one mediocre joke.
But the professor is a true believer. He says Washingtonians can improve relationships, even find solace in comedy.
Often when I get a cocktail party and people know that I'm a stand-up comic, they say, oh, tell us a joke. And I have to say to them, that really isn't the essence of the job. The essence of the job is to form a relationship with the audience so that the audience loses themselves, forget themselves, become unself-conscious, burst out laughing, and they end up looking at this guy on the stage thinking, that's a guy I want to spend time with. He makes me laugh. He gives me new insights. He gives me new ways of looking at typical problems, whether they're talking about fatherhood or students or death or dying or whatever I'm talking about up there on the stage. I want the audience to say, gosh, I hadn't thought of that before. That's a new way of looking at it.
Back at the bomb shelter, McBride and others are holding out hope that a local audience will catch the fresh new stand-ups before they migrate to more comic-friendly climes.
DC does have a sense of humor. They just don't know where it is. They don't know what's going on. We got other things to do. I'll see you later. But if they would just give it a shot, there's a lot of talent, and it's going to leave, so you might as well check it out.
For Metro Connection, I'm Stephanie Kay.
Up, the mysterious tale of James Hampton's throne. At 17 minutes before the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, high-tech companies say they can't find enough skilled workers. As a result, they're looking to foreign-born workers to fill open jobs. We'll discuss the connection between immigration and high-tech workers. That's Science Friday at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5. WAMU 88.5 invites you to attend an American Forum, Freedom of the Press in the Post-9/11 World, on the American University campus Monday night at 7. We'll discuss how fears of terrorism, increased government secrecy, and the unpopularity of the Iraq War have affected the freedom of the American press. In recognition of the anniversary of September 11th, WAMU 88.5 will broadcast this discussion Tuesday night at 10. More information is at WAMU.org. It's 88 degrees in Northwest Washington at 144 as we return now to Metro Connection.
Over a 14-year period, D.C.-based folk artist James Hampton secretly built an elaborate room-sized sculpture in his garage. It consisted of 180 objects assembled around a central throne and was not discovered until after his passing in 1964. Luckily, this is an hour-long show, so we'll just have enough time to mention the full name, the Throne of the Third Heaven of the Nation's Millennium General Assembly. The work did finally make it out of the garage, and we're here in its current home, the Smithsonian American Art Museum. We're joined by Jeff Bogato, the author of Mondo DC, an insider's guide to Washington, D.C.'s most unusual tourist attractions. And Jeff, I think this qualifies.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is one of the greatest pieces of folk art in the world. One guy built this. He was a janitor. You know, he built this in secret in a garage, and when it was uncovered, you know, it's just a masterpiece of what they call outsider art or visionary art.
Let's approach the James Hampton throne here. Give us a sense of what we're looking at. A huge collection of objects, some quite large, not made with the typical materials that we would expect sculpture to be made out of, that at least the kind of sculpture that you find in a museum.
That's right. It's quite a jumble of stuff. You know, one thing that's very prominent when you look at it is tinfoil, a lot of gold and silver tinfoil that he's used to cover a huge miscellany of objects, light bulbs, old furniture. He's used cardboard. You know, sometimes if you get close, you can see there's cardboard tubes.
Foil, paper, plastic, metal cut from coffee cans, light bulbs, tacks, pins, wooden furniture. It's all coming together to create this
What does it all mean? There's clearly a religious element to this. The name, again, the throne of the third heaven of the nation's Millennium General Assembly. What does this all mean?
To me, I think it's kind of a vision of what you would see, you know, at the second coming when you're approaching, you know, the throne of God. I mean, the title refers to the millennium. The third heaven is a reference to scriptures where there are apparently three heavens, the three levels of heaven. The first level was like the clouds. The second was the planetary level. And then you had the heaven of heavens, the third level where God resides. And this is where we are. And he also wrote a book of writings called the Book of the Seven Dispensation of St. James. And it's all written in a cryptic, made-up language, and nobody really knows what it means. It seems to be influenced by the Book of Revelations in the Bible, because at the bottom of every page he wrote in English, Revelation. So it's either a book of visions that he had, or it's a translation of the Book of Revelations in his own code.
But this code has not been cracked, even with all the hotshots at NSA, all the code breakers?
I don't know if they've turned it over to them. Maybe they should. But so far, nobody really knows what he was writing about in that particular book. But in that book, the dispensations is a reference to a special school of thought within fundamentalist Christian belief where there were seven dispensations. Time is divided into these seven periods, and the final period, the dispensation seven, is the second coming or the final judgment. And what are we looking at? We're approaching the throne of God at the final judgment, and this is kind of a model of what we would see at that time.
We mentioned some of the building materials, but we haven't mentioned the overall feeling that you get standing in front of this collection of objects. Very glittering surfaces, there's angel wings, there's the big throne that you mentioned with "Fear Not" written above it. What sense do you have approaching this?
Well, it's just sort of a magnificent set of objects, almost like what you would find when you open King Tut's tomb. You know, it's like this collection of just gold-covered, ornate objects fit for a king.
Some of the objects are more crudely fashioned than you would imagine in King Tut's tomb. It's not, but you know, this is a guy who was working in his garage and building this out of whatever found objects he could collect from the household.
Yeah, he collected a lot of things, possibly from the street or from secondhand shops. Apparently he paid homeless guys to give him foil from their cigarette packs or their wine bottles. So he used all kinds of materials like that to create this. They're only held together with a little bit of glue or tacks or even like straight pins. And only one layer is connected to the next layer. It's not like all fastened together. So these pieces are actually very fragile, and with age they've even gotten more fragile and more brittle.
Well, I'd imagine the curators are not used to dealing with objects like this one, put together, like you say, with tin foil and tacks.
Well, and, you know, too, he's using construction paper. Apparently he used a lot of purple construction paper, which is now faded to tan, and you can only imagine the lignins in that must just be a nightmare for any conservator. The acids in that paper just, you know, and the insulation board and stuff, it just must be just impossible to take care of.
Now, I know your answer to this is going to be, I don't know, but I have to ask. This guy writes a book in secret code that nobody can crack, and he works in total secrecy building this in his garage. Nobody knows he's working on it. Nobody knows it exists until after his passing. Why did he work in such secrecy?
Well, it wasn't that secretive in the sense that I think one way they found out about this, you know, some of the work that went into it and the meaning behind it a little bit is because his brother lived in Washington and he would apparently tell them a little bit about the project. You know, they had a vague understanding that, okay, you know, he's doing something and what does it mean? Apparently, you know, people might pass by the garage and kind of look in. So it wasn't completely done in secret, although he did apparently work at night mostly. He saw himself as a minister and as a counselor, and he called himself St. James. So it's possible that at some point when he finished this, that he might bring people in and actually hold services there or lectures of some kind.
Still, I get the sense that this is a man who was creating this piece in the middle of the night really for himself. That he was not interested in marketing himself as an artist and showing this off. This was something he had to do.
And that's the case with a lot of people that they classify as outsider artists or visionary artists. If you ask them are you an artist? Oh, no, I'm not an artist. When I met Clyde Jones in North Carolina, he's a guy who makes animals out of big logs and uses like old tennis balls for eyes and all kinds of found things. And his yard is just wall to wall of these animals. And he will not sell them. He will not give them away. And if you say to him, oh, are you an artist? Oh, no, I'm not an artist. But he very clearly is. And I think Hampton was certainly the same way. If you approached him, he wasn't an artist. He was a minister, and he was working on something potentially that was going to do the same thing that ministers do, is just teach the Word of God or teach about the Second Coming and the Millennium.
He was born in South Carolina but moved to D.C. at the age of 19. Was he known at all as an artist during his lifetime?
I don't think so. You know, I think when he moved up here, he was just doing like odd jobs, and then he was drafted into the Army in 1941. When he got out, he got a job as a janitor with the federal government.
How was it discovered in his garage? Who first discovered this thing?
When Hampton passed away in 1964, you know, he'd been renting this one garage since about 1950. When he passed away, the man he was renting the garage from hadn't heard from him and hadn't gotten a rent payment or something, so he asked around and then opened the garage up, and whoa, so that's what he's been doing all these years, you know. I think the guy had some idea that Hampton was working on something, but what it was, he really had no idea. And it's a good thing he just didn't throw it away, you know, just have it hauled out onto the street. But apparently he sold it to someone who then donated it to the Smithsonian. It's an anonymous donor.
It's such a fascinating story behind the creation of this piece, and that can only add to the allure and the attraction for wanting to see this piece.
Well, just the idea, too, that just, you know, the average person can, out of just very simple materials, create something so magnificent, and it's just, you know, such a masterpiece. And then when you think, wow, you know, gee, I could do that. You know, I could get a bunch of cardboard and just keep working, you know, for 14 years. You'd eventually, you know, in your basement, you'd eventually have something that must add to the allure.
Until your significant other grabbed all that stuff and kicked it out to the curb, you know, clear up this mess.
Well, that may have been Hampton's secret. He never got married, so that may have been his secret right there.
This is what's possible.
Yes, that's...
Boy, this is turning into a real Valentine's Day piece here, huh?
We're trying to understand this.
Once again, the title of this piece is The Throne of the Third Heaven of the Nation's Millennium General Assembly, created by artist James Hampton. D.C.-based folk artist James Hampton passed away in 1964. It's currently on display here at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And for more information, you can go to our website, metroconnection.org, to plan your visit to see it for yourself. Jeff, thanks for bringing us here today.
Yeah, good to see you again.
Jeff Bigotto is the author of Mondo D.C., an insider's guide to Washington, D.C.'s most unusual tourist attractions. And to wrap up the show today, writer Andrew Hiller doesn't claim to be the world's best singer. He'll be the first to tell you of his knack for forgetting the words. But he knows plenty about the transforming power of music.
The first thing to know about Judy is that Judy is not her name. Her real name is Rose. But when I met her, the only two syllables she could pronounce were Jew and T. Judy had a stroke, which impacted both her fine motor skills and her speech center. Imagine being completely cognitively intact, but without any ability to talk or write or pantomime. I met her at a nursing home where I volunteer. She fell in love with me because I once spent half an hour trying to figure out what kind of juice she wanted for breakfast. Judy could communicate, though. With a facial twist or dismissive wave of the hand, you knew exactly what she was feeling. Despite this, the nursing assistants and staff had long given up on trying to talk to her. They directed her. It's time to go to therapy. It's time for your pills. Here's your lunch. And Judy sometimes would protest by boycotting a lunch she disliked, or by vigorously shaking her head. But mostly, at least when I was there, she found ways to get by. My big activity at the nursing home is the sing-along. It gathers a pretty big crowd, too, because I sing their songs, the songs they loved, and because, fairly often, I don't know them. There's something immensely comforting to seniors with memory issues about me stumbling over a lyric or shrugging and humming for a bit. It's like saying that forgetting is okay. On one particular day, I'm singing and Judy joins us. She's in full throat and loudly making music. Once upon a time, Judy was a musician, a pianist, her daughter confided in me. It's nice to hear her. It's unintelligible, but joyous. The little miracle happens when I begin my patriotic repertoire. I began singing God Bless America. I don't know if it was a hemispheric issue, if singing accesses a different part of the brain, but Judy begins singing, the actual words. And even more, she knows that she is. She knows that she's being heard and understood, and tears begin to flow down her cheeks. The song finished, and so did her moment of clarity. But we understood. Judy was still Rose.
Andrew Hiller is a writer living in Silver Spring. And for this week, that's Metro Connection. We had extra production help from Andrew Chadwick, Ken Mason, and Matthew McCleskey. The show's theme song, Zero Wave, was written and performed by the D.C. area band, Astralight. You can hear Metro Connection on the web, and you can also download a podcast. Just go to our webpage, metroconnection.org. We'd like to thank Jason Novak and Will Horton for keeping the page up to date every week. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is metro@wamu.org. I'm David Furst, and this has been Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5. You can't.